Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000, or you can send checks to the trust account of Daniel Horowitz. He's my attorney. P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Daniel Horowitz, attorney, P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Say it's for Michael Savage. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Go to www.michaelsavage.com, and God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech. I was laying in bed last night about 3 in the morning when I started to laugh out loud. And I rarely laugh out loud in bed because it would disturb the dog. He'll think I'm crazy. And I started to laugh hysterically because the thought occurred to me that when I was a youth and still living with my parents, maybe 17, 16, 17 era, I left pretty young. I don't know when I left, 20. I have no idea when. I remember coming home after a night of carousing with my friends. Well, frankly, I remember coming home to that little attached brick house with the rock-solid front door and turning that lock. There's something about that door. I've never been able to duplicate the doors they had on houses in those days and the locks. When you turn the tumbler on those houses, you heard the tumbler turn. You felt like Willie Sutton breaking into a bank. It was such a wonderful sound. And the minute the door opened, mothballs and heat assailed all of your senses. My mother kept the heat up at around, I'd say, 90 in the winter. And she put mothballs in every article of clothing known to me, and like the whole closet. You got to picture this house, an attached house, so to speak, semi-attached, right? Brick, a row house, in other words. Think of a British movie from the 50s. Remember those movies, brick attached houses? Now think Queens, 50s, post-war attached houses. Small, maybe 20 feet wide, the lot's 100 feet long, the house is maybe, what, 20 by 60, the yard's 40, front and rear, I don't really know. But the house was narrow, but it worked for me. It was like, to me, a palace after where we had come from. And when I got in that, so mothballs were in every clothing bag, but more than the clothing bags, in the hallway when you went in. And so hallway, you had to walk in sideways into the vestibule. But to me, it was wonderful. I didn't care it was a small hallway. At least I had a hallway. To the immediate right of the hallway was a closet door. She had mothballs in there. Every piece of clothing and a vacuum cleaner to go with it. Everything was neat. Don't get me wrong. Nothing was jumbled. But in every coat, a mothball. The woman had, God bless her, she had a phobia about bugs. I don't know what it was. To keep the fur. I don't know what. But I used to say, my, it's so hot in here. My eyes are smarting from the mothballs. Never mind. I like the heat. That was the end of the discussion. There was no discussing it at that point. She would have been great in talk radio, my mother. She closed the argument down just by answering what you started to say. There was no discussion. Never mind, I like the heat. That was it. There was no arguing, no reasoning. Perfect caller to a radio show. Actually, perfect host. But what was this thing with the mothballs? I don't understand. I'm starting to think there may have been a health benefit to mothballs that we don't even understand yet. That's when I broke into laughter in bed, and Teddy rolled over and looked at me like I was crazy. Play Jingle Bell Rock, would you?
Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell Rock. Jingle Bell Swing.
Oh, I'm not going to get too wound up today. Much.
Snowing and blowing.
I'm not going to get too wound up today. Not.
Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell.
Seen the pictures of me yet? That's a great picture with the sunglasses.
Jingle Bell time.
If I didn't have the brains I have, I would have been a movie star. Holy, that's a great line. You know, I'm looking at myself, how good-looking I really was at my birthday, which wasn't too long ago. If I didn't have the brains I was gifted with, I would have been a movie star by now. And just think of what you would have lost. Indianapolis, Scott, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Your Mama Savage was onto something with the mothballs. She probably never saw a mouse or anything in her house as long as she kept those mothballs going.
She hated mice. She was terrified of them. But she was trying to kill the moths. How did she kill the mice?
The one of the chemicals in the mothballs, apparently, because my mother and my grandmother did the same thing. They never had mice in their house, and according to a like home remedies book that my mother had, the mothballs, one of the chemicals in them, is a deterrent to mice.
You're kidding. She was terrified of mice. She was a strong woman and not very frightful, but terrified of mice. And I remember once we were in a rented cottage in the mountains, and a mouse got in the cottage. There were no mothballs there because she primarily used them in the in the house we lived in. She didn't have any up in the mountains. And man, she jumped up on a chair screaming with a broom at the mouse. Why are women afraid of mice? I don't want to go into it. I'm sorry. This is going to start. Anyway, thanks for the call. I got the picture. I don't want to go into it.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Tucson, Arizona. TJ, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I'm responding to the comments Sally Fields made about if women were ruling things, this world would be better and there wouldn't be any wars. My contention that if women were ruling things, this world would be far worse than what it is. And I cite the examples is the dating habits of women. There are a lot of men joining the Bloods and the Crips to get girls. A lot of times that I've been picked on or harassed or whatever by men, it was because they were trying to get the sexual favors of other women. It was a woman.
You're saying that men fight with each other because of women to show that they're more dominant?
And I'm also saying that because women are responsive to that, by virtue of that, they encourage violence in men.
Some women do. I would say that is true. There's actually a biological, imperative in the sense that the women want the most viable male to produce offspring with. She wants usually a man who can defend her and who is, more liable to produce a strong child. When it gets carried to the extreme of killing over a woman, of course, I think that's another story. But look, let's look at the animal kingdom in order to draw some conclusions, TJ. The moose who will bang heads in order to attract the female. Wherever you look, you're going to see male animals fighting with each other in order to get the female. Isn't that true? Look at the lions. They'll chase the old male, will be chased away eventually by a younger lion. He is then shunned from the tribe. He's no longer considered a viable mate for the women, the girl lions, the female lions, rather. They want the most viable male. And in our society, the women tend to want a nerdy guy today rather than the macho guy. The smart women do, because they know the nerdy guy will make more money and probably is smart enough to avoid getting killed.
Uh-huh. Well, see, you're making the point that in order to impress a woman, you have to behave like an animal.
I mean, you got me there, TJ. And by the way, I'm not going to argue with you.
It was a woman who wanted the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter.
TJ, you set me up pretty good on that one. I got to thank you for it. I don't know any examples in history of benevolent women leaders, do you? I mean, which women leaders come to mind as let's say there'd be no wars if there were women leaders? Who are they thinking about? Let's say there was a woman leader of Pakistan. Remember Bhutto? Her father had been assassinated. Then she became a leader of Pakistan. I mean, wherever you look. Okay, Golda Meir, she was far more macho and had more of more testosterone than Shimon Peres. How about Margaret Thatcher? I mean, I admire those women, but they weren't peaceniks. None of them were.
But sometimes you need to have war. Sometimes if you avoid a war, it causes a war. I mean, for example—
Absolutely, and sometimes it's better to have a war early on before your enemy becomes too strong and you're going to—let's, for example, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Right now, he's a pipsqueak. He can be wiped out overnight. He has no military to speak of. He is, though, in cahoots with Ahmadinejad. He's trying to get nuclear weapons. He's buying submarines. This guy, if he is not stopped, will wind up causing a bigger war, and there'll be more Americans and Venezuelans dying 5 years from now or 10 years from now than they would die right now. So an argument can be made that he should be stopped before he gets bigger. I think that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, go back to World War II. Had William Chamberlain had not been appeasing Hitler, and had we just taken him out from the beginning? As a matter of fact, I heard a story that the orders were cut to arrest Hitler for violating the previous treaties from World War I.
Yes, and, you're 100% right. If Hitler had been stopped at Munich, World War II could have been aborted. Tens of millions of people wouldn't have died. It's the same with Ahmadinejad coming to New York. Why should a new Hitler, which is who Ahmadinejad is spiritually, intellectually, in every way, he's saying the same things Hitler did. He wants the nuclear weapons so he can terrorize the world and kill people. He does not want it for peaceful reasons. If that man was stopped now, we could avoid a larger war, which is why, thank God, George Bush is showing all the signs of doing the right thing, and so is France. I hope they do. I hope they do go ahead with it. I don't know where you stand on that one. Do you think we should go and take out Iranian military targets?
Oh, definitely. I think we should have done that when we went in with Iraq at the same time. Oh, getting back to women, though, there's a belief system that women mature faster than men, and I don't believe that. I believe women just at an earlier age desire to have a mate. That does not necessarily equate with the fact that women are mature, because all you have to do is look at how they behave in divorce courts.
You know, you're the best misogynist I've had on in years, TJ. You really sound jaundiced. What happened to you?
Well, first of all, some of the most cruelest things have either been done to me either by women or by men who were trying to impress women, and I've made those observations very young in life. I wasn't even a teenager by that point, and I don't worship women.
I'm not going to argue with you. You're not the only man on earth who feels a little intimidated by the gentle sex. All I know is this. When the Year of the Woman came along in Congress around 92, 93, 94, do you remember the speeches we heard? That when women were elected, we'd have a more gentler Congress, et cetera. Now, I ask you, when you look at Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Mikulski, do you feel that we have a gentler, kinder Congress?
We have a cattier Congress.
Well, let's look at Dianne Feinstein and her husband, Richard Blum. Would you say that we have a more honest Senate with Dianne Feinstein as a U.S. Senator?
No,
do you think that if a man did what Dianne Feinstein allegedly is doing, in terms of steering contracts from committees that she sat on, defense contracts to her. Let's say it was a man sitting on a defense committee, and he steers contracts to his wife's consulting firm, and she's worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Do you think that man would have stayed in office as long as Dianne Feinstein has?
Yes, sir, as long as he was a catty, effeminized, liberal man. Yes, sir.
You got me there again. You have a pretty good sense of humor, TJ. How do you survive in Tucson, Arizona? Are you calling from penitentiary?
In a way, yes, sir.
You incarcerated? Because I did invite people from prisons to call last week.
No,
are you actually calling from? You're not in a lock. You're in a mental hospital or a prison?
No, I meant that more figuratively, not literally.
I know you did. I was just kidding. But you have any relationships with women at all? Mother, sister, children, daughters? No.
Right now, I'm trying to get over a sports injury, so I'm staying away from the dating scene. But to be honest with you, it was my sister who re-injured my sporting injury.
So you're saying you were in a cast and she came in and twisted your ankle?
More specifically, I have torn cartilage in my back, and she took me on this Bag Mountain dirt road with a bunch of potholes on it, and I told her that I had a physician's order to stay off of pothole-ridden roads. She lied to me, and her husband drove like about 50 miles an hour over the potholes, and so I have an MRI report that shows that my disc was healing.
And oh, my God. This is a really serious story here. So you're a little leery of women to begin with. Now, on top of it all, your own blood turns out to be untrustworthy when it comes to this.
Let me tell you this story. Whenever I'm in bars and I'm meeting women, they're telling me about how rotten the ex-boyfriends were and abusive. I ask them, what's he doing? And when they kind of shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know, I'll tell them straight up, well, if you can't even tell me what the problem is and what he's doing, how do I know that you're not the one that's instigating the bad behaviors? And, you know, a lot of women are actually turned on by that. You know, I've never had a drink thrown in my face, but the bottom line is you can go into barrooms all over the country with a bunch of women who are berating their exes, and every man knows that they're lying and whatever it is they did that to provoke that the problem is being left out of the story. But still, men will,
Oh, yeah, of course. So, you know you have to go, stare them in the eye, too, and buy them another drink.
See, nobody tells women the truth that they, when they're wrong, and so what you have is a whole society of women who really don't have a good fix.
Yeah, wait. You want to get a heart attack? Tell a woman when she's wrong. Have you met a woman yet who will admit she's wrong in your whole life?
I've met some women where you could get away with it more than other women, and I'm
amazed. There are some brilliant, intelligent women out there who can never admit they're wrong, though. There's something about the feline nature of a woman that it's very hard for them to say they were wrong. I don't get that. I don't understand that part of it. If I'm wrong, I admit I'm wrong. It's not easy for me, but I'll have to admit it in order to go forward myself. Okay, you're an honest guy. I want to ask you something. You heard the story I read today from the website. Federal prosecutor arrested in child sex thing. He was trying to have sex with a 5-year-old girl. What do you think of a story like this? What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction to that is the death penalty for people who do things like that. One trial, one appeal, and that'll get rid of those kinds of problems.
But could you believe this man works for the U.S. Justice Department as an assistant U.S. attorney in Florida?
Yes, sir, I can. I mean, just look at the activities of the ACLU and what our criminal judicial system is letting them get away with.
You're good. TJ, you should head up the Savage Nation in Tucson. You're like a one-man Savage Nation in Tucson.
I could probably do it for maybe 15 minutes. And
you wouldn't have patience, I know. Well, let me send you a gift. I got to send you a gift. You pick it. You want the CD? You want the Healing Children Naturally? You want the Alzheimer's book? Anything else I can send you from the cornucopia of Savage Items?
The CD would be great.
TJ, stay on the line. We're going to get you the Michael Savage DVD Freedom of Speech Award by Talkers Mag. You'll see me gesticulating wildly with my New Yorker hands.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show. Savage. To an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
As part of our dissection of the CARE organization, we've asked journalist Robert Spencer, who has also written an article for humanevents.com called Do It Our Way, about CARE. Thanks for speaking with the Savage Nation, Mr. Spencer.
Michael, it's great to talk with you. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the show.
Robert, you've discovered that CARE has what they call a media guide. What is this media guide intended for, and what does it contain?
The Council on American Islamic Relations has issued a guide for American journalists that's designed to help them understand Islam and understand how to deal with Islamic issues. And so it clears up what they call misconceptions about Islam, including, for example, the idea that the Quran teaches violence and that Islam is incompatible with democracy. It, of course, completely ignores the fact that it's Muslims themselves around the world who have been saying that that the Quran teaches violence and that Islam is incompatible with democracy. The CARE guide, by contrast, pretends that it's non-Muslims who have originated these ideas.
What are the perceptions of Islam in the U.S. and around the world, and are they justified?
Well, I think that there is a significant number of people around the world and in the United States who believe that there is a connection between Islam and terrorism, and that's what CARE is worried about, and that's why they've issued this media guide. But it's entirely reasonable because, after all, it's Muslims themselves who have insisted that there's a connection between Islam and terrorism. And they have emphasized that they are doing these actions of violence in order to further the goals of the Islamic religion. With that being the case, it's hard to see why anybody should object to the connection of Islam and terrorism. As a matter of fact, if CARE is really a moderate group, as it professes to be, it ought to be admitting that there is a connection and then working for genuine reform instead of attacking the people who are merely noting the fact that Muslims themselves are making the connection between Islam and terrorism.
Many Muslims have come out to support this form of extremism again and again. Can you give us some examples of how Muslims have identified themselves with terrorism?
Absolutely. Osama bin Laden's appeal is explicitly Islamic. He constantly and consistently portrays himself as the representative of pure Islam and true Islam. Osama bin Laden is not alone in this either. This is the nature of the appeal that jihadists make among peaceful Muslims around the world. They go into communities of Muslims and they say, this is what the Quran says. The Quran teaches to make war against unbelievers. The Quran teaches to subjugate the unbelievers under the rule of Islamic law as inferiors. And so if you want to be a real Muslim, a true Muslim, you have to do this. Osama bin Laden recently issued a communique to the people of Pakistan calling upon them to rise up against the Musharraf regime precisely because he said it's insufficiently Islamic. And he based his appeal on 10 Quran verses, which he explained in great detail and explained in a way as to make it clear that that the Quran gave Muslims a responsibility to establish an Islamic state and not a state that is only Muslim in name, like Musharraf, according to Osama bin Laden. Another example is the Ayatollah Khomeini, the Iranian revolutionary, who he very famously said, I spit on the foolish souls who say that Islam teaches peace. There are hundreds of Quranic verses and hadith, that is, traditions of Muhammad, which teach that Muslims must wage war and fight against the infidels. And so this is something that is consistent throughout all the statements of Islamic terrorists around the world. They appeal to the Quran and they say that they are fighting war based on what Allah has commanded them to do.
Why, in your opinion, hasn't CARE renounced extreme Islam if they're truly trying to reshape the Western view and image of the religion?
Well, CARE will say they've condemned terrorism, and they point to many condemnations of terrorism. The problem is they've never defined terrorism, and they say they condemn attacks on innocent civilians, and that's all very well, too, except that Islamic jihadists have repeatedly said that no non-Muslims are innocent, and particularly Americans and Israelis are not innocent civilians. And so the CARE condemnations of terrorism have been vague at best. Meanwhile, CARE has had several officials arrested and convicted on terrorism-related activities. It itself was founded by some people from the Islamic Association for Palestine, which is a Hamas front. It was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation terror charity funding case. And there are numerous other things that indicate that maybe CARE doesn't come out more clearly and more firmly and more specifically against Islamic terrorism because they don't oppose it. And that is, they don't oppose it in its particular form. I've been on shows with CARE officials. I've been on several radio shows with Hussam Ailush of CARE California. I've been on television with Ibrahim Hooper and other CARE officials. And when I was on a show recently with Ailush, I asked him repeatedly, point blank, will you condemn Hamas and Hezbollah as terrorist groups? And he repeatedly refused.
So in your opinion, CARE does not support moderate Islam. Where are the moderate Muslim groups who will come out and protest and say this will not be done in the name of my religion? Where are those people? Are there moderate Muslims? I know there has to be.
There are a few courageous individuals who are speaking out. My late friend Tashbih Syed of Muslim World Today was one. And there is Zudi Jasser out of Arizona. And there are several others who are very courageous individuals, very forthrightly speaking about the necessity to reform Islam and that these people must not be allowed to represent the majority of Muslims. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. They're not large movements. They're not large groups. And they do not have the initiative in the Islamic community today.
What is it that indicates to you that reform is not really what CARE has on its agenda?
Well, I'd say that the main indication that CARE does not have Islamic reform on its agenda is that they don't speak about it. CARE, for example, could have and should have, after 9/11, instituted programs in American mosques if they were really against the jihad ideology, teaching against the jihad ideology and making sure that it wasn't spread in the United States, they could have called upon Muslims to cooperate fully and openly with anti-terror initiatives and with law enforcement officials. Instead, they've tried to impede those law enforcement officials and anti-terror initiatives in any way that they can. They're one of the sponsors of the Flying Imams lawsuit, which was the lawsuit, which still is the lawsuit that has been brought against U.S. Airways by a few Muslim imams who say that they were taken off a U.S. Airways flight for behaving suspiciously when really, they say, it was just racism and bigotry. The passengers also who reported their suspicious behavior were originally named in the suit, and this is a very telling indication of where CARE and its allies really, where their loyalties really lie, because the only winner out of such a lawsuit would have been jihad terrorists, who would then have a free hand to behave in any way they wanted on in airports and on airplanes, and nobody would be reporting them because they'd be afraid they'd get sued.
And as you have mentioned in your article, they've engaged in a number of commercial actions as well.
Yes, they have. They have engaged in numerous attempts to silence and to discredit people who speak about the threat of Islamic Jihad and people who speak about the use that Islamic jihadists make of Islamic texts and teachings to justify their actions and make recruits among peaceful Muslims. They intimidated Fox Network into running a disclaimer on the 24 show when they depicted Islamic terrorists. They intimidated National Review magazine into dropping advertising for a biography of Muhammad, even though everything in the biography was accurate and taken from Islamic sources. They have tried consistently to silence people who speak about Islamic violence and Islamic supremacism, even when they're merely quoting Muslims who make violent and supremacist statements themselves.
So they come out with this media guide. Doesn't the very idea of a media guide, a guide outlining what the media should say, seem very unconstitutional? What does it tell us about the sheeple in the media? It certainly doesn't stand in line with the First Amendment, with freedom of speech.
Yeah, it's totalitarian in concept, really. It's the idea that there should be a media guide and that journalists should watch what they say about Muslims and Islam is completely contrary to the First Amendment, to freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry. It's, of course, being sold by CARE as if the American press is completely witless about Islam and ignorant, and CARE is going to enlighten us all. But of course, what they really want to do is, it's quite clear from their actions thus far, is just preclude any honest investigation of the elements of Islam that give rise to violence and thereby foreclose on any possibility of genuine reform.
Robert Spencer, thanks for answering our questions. Come back to the Savage Nation anytime.
Michael, it's always great to speak with you. Thanks again for having me on.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
There are people on Earth who spend every waking minute trying to figure out how to kill us, harm us, and destroy other people. Their entire life, from the morning they wake up until they go to sleep at night, is how to kill, how to maim, how to hurt, and how to humiliate other people. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. We have a nation that spends millions of dollars to keep an alcoholic stew bum alive if he should trip and break his hand in the streets. EMS, the ambulances, and Mr. Smith, and how are you, and rush him to the hospital and around, get the oxygen. And there he is. Every life is precious. You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars later, and there's the bum in the street puking on himself again 3 weeks later. Every life is precious. But at what cost, I ask myself? It's like everyone votes. Yeah, that really makes sense to me. It sure does. That's why we get the kind of leaders we have. Everyone votes. Like, there are certain rules I would establish as to why everyone shouldn't vote. Like, let's start with an IQ test. That would be the minimum. Okay, number one, speak English. You can't speak English, you don't vote. That means you don't know what's going on. You have no right to be in the country to begin with, but you don't want to learn a language. Then you don't have the right to vote. That's A. B, an IQ test. Minimum 100. Okay, 100. 100 IQ should be the breaking point. Number three, you're on welfare, you don't vote. because you're only going to vote yourself a raise at the expense of those who are paying your salary. Okay? You lose the privileges that you had before you went on public assistance. That might save America right there. But then I think about life, man. You know, everything is so precious. And then we got people on this earth, radical Islamists. I never really encountered this in studying history going back perhaps until a time in history of Attila the Hun, who, let's say, ransacked every city and killed everyone in the city that he invaded. But to be facing an enemy of such barbarism is hard to believe for a society that is so, you would say, evolved, but it's actually quite barbaric itself. We in the West are living in a sort of post-Christian barbarism. Now, that's a very interesting topic that I wanted to get to. But the sexual liberation movement, the progressives, let's start with the progressives. What do they advocate? Sexual liberation. What has it led to? Homosexuality, transsexuality, bisexuality, abortion on demand, round-the-clock pornography, soft drugs, euthanasia for anyone who's not perfect. And so, therefore, we are living in this postmodern liberalism, which has become, in essence, a form of cultural barbarism. Under the guise of tolerance and acceptance, we are actually a barbaric civilization. And all of the traditions that we grew up with are being steamrolled over by these cultural degenerates. Abortions become the norm. Divorce becomes the norm. Pornography is acceptable. Drugging yourself is acceptable. Being a single mother is acceptable. Teenage sluts is acceptable. Bisexuality, homosexuality, transsexuality are considered lifestyle choices. And now the Dutch want to go a step further. It's not enough that they have sex museums and sex clubs. It's not enough that whores advertise their bodies in storefront windows. It's not enough that marijuana is legal. No, that's not good enough. It's not good enough that euthanasia is rampant in Holland going down to the age of 12. What are the last frontiers for the cultural degenerate barbarians? It's child pornography and engaging in pedophilia. A new group, a new party called Charity, Freedom, and Diversity, with emphasis on the last word, because I've told you for years, I was the first one to tell you in my first book, The Savage Nation, that diversity is a code word for perversity. The newly formed Charity, Freedom, and Diversity Party advocates reducing the legal age for sex from 16 to 12. The Dutch pedophiles are also demanding that child pornography and sex with animals should be legal. They also said that citizens should be allowed to go naked in public. And their party platform is, we're going to shake The Hague awake. Now, their ultimate goal is to abolish any limits on the legal age for sex with any child at any age. Their argument is that a ban just makes children curious. This is the world in collapse. This is the West in collapse. This is the world that we are trying to make sense out of. It is impossible to make sense out of a cultural barbarism of this kind. And so when you hear the word progressive, or when you hear the word diversity, you've got to understand who is behind it. And you've got to understand what you're fighting for. And you've got to understand that this is connected to the rise of radical Islam throughout the West. They are absolutely part and parcel of the same exact situation. Now, let me explain that in more detail for those of you who want to hear it. How do I relate the rise of radical Islam with its restrictions, with its throwback mentality, and with its hatred and its murderous nature with the progressive movement in the West? It's quite simple. You have to think about biology to understand it. You have to think of the AIDS virus, which is symptomatic, actually symbolic, rather, of what I'm talking about. The AIDS virus is actually quite symbolic. It's a retrovirus, and it invades the body, but it doesn't really cause an infection for a while. It lays in wait. And while it lays in wait, the retrovirus, the HIV virus, it starts to attack the immune system itself. And only after the immune system itself is weakened can infections arise within the human being that has been infected with the HIV virus. This is what liberalism is. Liberalism is, in essence, the HIV virus. And it weakens the defense cells of a nation. What are the defense cells of a nation? Well, the church. They've attacked particularly the Catholic Church for 30 straight years. The police attacked for the last 50 straight years by the ACLU viruses. And the military attacked for the last 50 years by the Barbara Boxer viruses on our planet. And so when they weaken our defense cells, what happens is the opportunistic infections arise because our surveillance is not permitted. The reaction of our white blood cells is diminished because they're not permitted to react because they've been weakened by the liberal virus. And consequently, infections arise. So what are these infections? Well, you can name many of them. Now enter the arise of radical Islam into the Western world. How does that fit in? It is a counterpoint. It's actually part of God's plan, as I see it. I know this is shocking. Many of you can't follow where I'm going, but I'll go where I have to go in order to traverse through this jungle of thought. This is all part and parcel of God's plan. God is saying to us in the West, I have given you the Garden of Eden. I have given you the milk and the honey that is promised in the Bible. And you have despoiled the land I have given you. You have destroyed and despoiled the Garden of Eden that I have given you. And so therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce an element into this Garden of Eden so that you can see there are consequences to your behavior. And they are going to kill you. They're going to cut your throats. They're going to keep doing this until you realize how far you have gone astray. That's how I see it. It's amazing. But, I mean, many of you don't want to accept this. Many of you want to think that radical Islam has arisen in a vacuum. It hasn't risen in a vacuum. It is arising as a counterpoint to the cultural barbarism of the West. Make no mistake about it. Yes, you can also include territorial expansionism, if you wish, meaning the desire for Islam to sweep across the planet as it had once done before when it conquered two-thirds of the planet through the sword and through the flame and through throat cutting. They're just doing it again, only this time they're achieving it not so much with the sword and the flame, but with the very techniques of liberalism that are in place in our societies that have gulled us and made us lay down our normal weapons of survival. Through the sword of tolerance, through the sword of acceptance, through the sword of liberalism, if you want to put it in that category, the radical Islamic movement is causing the greatest upheaval in our society and our Western societies that has been seen since the Industrial Revolution. We are going through, in essence, a radical religious revolution. And either the people in the West come to understand that they're going to disappear, their children will certainly not survive, or their grandchildren won't be here as we know it. They will not be here. If you take the arc we are on, and you see the kind of leadership that we don't have, and you see the kind of appeasement going on from our so-called hawkish leaders, I see a very terrible prognosis for our children.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000, or you can send checks to the trust account of Daniel Horowitz. He's my attorney. P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Daniel Horowitz, attorney, P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Say it's for Michael Savage. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Go to www.michaelsavage.com, and God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech. Savage.
Alcohol can compete with your affections. It sure did in my case. You know, and affections would be affections for your family or affections for, exercise. And what is a difficult a difficult thing to do, which is to kick an addiction. And I did. It wasn't easy, but I quit drinking. I had too much to drink one night, and the next night I didn't have any. Next day, and I decided to quit and haven't had a drink since 1986. And, you know, I'm a better man for it. It's hard for me to speculate, but I doubt I'd be standing here if I hadn't quit drinking whiskey and beer and wine and all that. But it's, and there's some people who can handle it through moderation. I was just a person that, you know, I wasn't a knee-walking drunk, but as I say, it just competed. And it was the competition that I finally decided wasn't worth it.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell swing and jingle bells ring.
George, do us all a favor. Have a drink. George, do us a favor. Have a drink. Maybe you'll pardon the Marine or a Border Patrol agent instead of moonshiners. George, please have a drink for this new year. Do me a favor. Maybe Sarkozy can send you a bottle of Dom. I mean, something. Try a drink again. It couldn't be bad. Your popularity will soar. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Who is singing this song, this luscious song? Bobby who? Helms? Jesse Helms' grandson? It is the Savage Nation. So our president, thanks for the song, guys. President Bush granted pardons to carjackers, drug dealers, a moonshiner, but not to a single U.S. Marine or a Border Patrol agent. In all, Mr. Bush pardoned 29 convicts and reduced the prison sentence of one more in an end-of-the-year presidential tradition. So why he wouldn't have pardoned Colonel Chesani, why he wouldn't have pardoned the two Border Patrol agents when nearly 100 congressmen have said pardon the Border Patrol agents, they were set up for a fall by a drug dealer and some corrupt officials down in Texas. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. That's why I'm playing in Jingle Bell Rock. WOR, Norm, you're on the Savage Nation.
Good evening, Michael. The other day during Hanukkah, a group of, I believe, four Jewish young men were on the subway, and they were attacked by anti-Semites. They beat them. They hit them. Turned out the boys who hit them were Polish. No surprise there.
So what is this? So it's an attempt to put down Polish people? What's the purpose of the call?
No. They turned out to be Polish. Polish people.
So what? Wait a minute. So what? What does Polish have to do with it?
Explain in a second. They were helped. The Jewish boys were helped by a Muslim man. He protected.
I know that. Hassan Askari came to their rescue. He got a black eye for his trouble.
Right.
He is a good Samaritan who tried to stop the subway beating. He has two black eyes. He's a Bangladeshi Muslim from Manhattan. And he headed to the help of the young women confronted by the group of 10 thugs. And that is the hope for America, is that moderate Muslims such as he will participate in the mainstream of this society, unlike CAIR, which pretends to be a member of representing the moderate Muslims, when in fact, many of us have come to believe otherwise. Norm?
Can I say something about the Polish?
No, you cannot. And I'm sorry that you put that in the air. I have no idea why you have to say, hey, they were Polish. Why did that matter? Why does that matter? They were Polish. How about if I tell you about the good Polish people? See, I don't understand it. You're trying to make a positive thing, so you have to put somebody down. I don't like that. That's all. What else is in the news here? Emission limit passes test. Levi's tries on new chairman. Isn't that a sad? That company is so sad, the Levi Strauss company. The grandfather came out and he made dungarees for miners. The great-grandfather, Levi Strauss, the old guy. He knew a miner worked a gold mine. He needed a pair of dungarees. He made a fortune. Made a fortune with basic work pants. Now, several generations later, they got the grandson, the moron, who has run the company into the ground like Sulzberger. It's very typical, by the way. The English have a phrase for this, from sandals to sandals in three generations. So they got the grandsons, the morons, and the ones that married in, the half-idiots, who married the ugly daughters, who instead of worrying about making a good pair of pants that somebody wants to buy or a shirt somebody wants to buy, instead they worked on social. You ever drive past the Levi Plaza in San Francisco? It looks like a futuristic lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender workplace experiment. Everybody's there like on a social program. Nobody actually works. They walk around the equivalent of a park. They have a lunchroom. They have special places for the lesbian, gay, trisexual children to be left during the day. But to make a pair of pants like the grandfather, they don't know how. They forgot the nature of the business is to turn a profit. Oh, and I forgot to mention that on the windows of their stores, they show you how sensitive they are in the sewing of their garments, that they're sewn by green-friendly slaves somewhere on Earth who love working in a factory. Every time I walk by like a coffee shop in San Francisco, it's like a lecture. Eco-friendly coffee grown in a green environment. What do I care? What do I care? Now you took the business away from places where they grew coffee all of a sudden because they weren't eco-friendly enough. So you drove people out. Probably you took their jobs away. Play Jingle Bell Rock. I got to catch my breath. I don't even care about it. I don't care now.
Jingle Bell That's time all. Is a swell time.
What's this guy in line 10, Beowulf? What's he asking me? On what? Why?
Jingle around the clock. Mix and a mingle in the jingling feet. That's the Jingle Bell Rock.
All right, Jingle Bell Rock. All right, take it off. Let's go to North Carolina where we have a hater. Chris, welcome to the Savage Nation. Why are you a hater today?
Oh, I'm a hater. I'm a hater because I want to ask you why you won't allow the man to address the fact that these individuals were Polish, these super intelligent Polish people who born two Jewish girls. And the Muslim comes to their defense. You don't want to allow the man to speak about that?
Wait, how did you learn a Muslim came to their defense? Where'd you learn it?
I learned it just now.
Oh, thank you. You made my point. Have a nice day. 1-800-449-8255 is the. It's good to be smart. Thank God, God gave me the ability to understand the idiots faster than they can even understand themselves. He learns on this show that it was a Muslim who came to the defense of the Jews, and he says to me, "I'm a bigot because I didn't tell him about a Muslim coming to the defense of Jews when I just told it to him." And he learned it here. And he's telling. Oh, I give up.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
We've talked about hate crimes before, usually with a follow-up on thought crimes. Selwyn Duke has printed an article addressing a case involving a black Baltimore fireman, a picture of a noose, and thought police. He's with us now. Hi there, Selwyn.
Hello, Michael. Nice to be with you again. Michael, people might remember the story from a while back about the black firefighter who reported a so-called hate crime in East Baltimore. He said he found a knotted rope and threatening note with a picture of a noose on it in his firehouse. Well, guess what? Now we know that the fireman, his name is Donald Maynard, planted the object himself. Now, Michael, the city's mayor, Sheila Dixon, had been very upset about this incident, and she fanned the flames of racial unrest, basically saying that racism was running rampant in the city. But listen to this. Now that we know that the perpetrator isn't white, she says that the offender won't be charged criminally.
This is insane. Why isn't he going to be charged?
Well, look, Michael, that's an excellent question. And I don't want to be misunderstood here. As you know, I've been an ardent opponent of hate crime laws because, as more and more people are starting to realize, they're an effort at thought control. So I don't believe anyone should be prosecuted simply for displaying politically incorrect symbols. But what do they say, Michael? The best way to eliminate an unjust law is to enforce it across the board. And come on, if the perpetrator had been white, you can bet that there'd be a hate crime charge right now. Now, of course, some are going to say, well, it's obvious why Maynard won't be charged. He was just perpetrating a hoax. Hatred had nothing to do with it. But how do we know that? Maybe he hated white people so much that he wanted to demonize them through this act.
Oh, but of course, that's not the kind of hatred we care about, right, Selwyn?
Well, of course, we know that it's not, and that's the problem. Another thing, though, Michael, is, do we really think that every white person who displays these symbols is driven by hatred? Don't white people perpetrate hoaxes, too? I mean, there's no shortage of folks, let's face it, who just love causing mayhem and reading about their handiwork in the news. But funny thing, The hoax defense never seems to work with white people. In fact, Michael, here's what we're told. Listen to this. They say such acts are so damaging to the wider targeted community that harsher punishment is warranted. Well, here's the thing. Wasn't that ill-defined damage done between the time Maynard made his report and the time he admitted it was false? And it seems to me also that if the damage is the same, the punishment should be identical to what a white person would get. I mean, look, we have to ask, are we judging the act or the skin color? And there's another important point to be made here, Michael. If ever, ever there was an unjust type of racial profiling, this is it.
This is insane. This is exactly why liberals claim to be opposed to profiling.
Well, yes, Michael, that's an excellent point, and I'd like to touch on that. Now, look, like I've said before, I have no problem with authorities considering racial factors when constructing a profile. I've defended that practice. Look, I'd be the first to say, let me tell you, that if a black church is burned and swastikas are found, I'd be far more likely to look for suspects among the local white population. But, and this is important, that would be a proper application of profiling because we'd be using it simply to narrow down a list of possible suspects. What's happening here is a lot different. We're not using racial characteristics to identify the most likely suspects here. We're using them to determine guilt. In other words, Michael, it's one thing to just operate with the understanding that certain motivations are more likely to be found among certain racial groups, like Nazi sentiments among whites. Here, though, we're assuming that because an individual is of a certain racial group, he must have a certain motivation. Michael, this isn't just generalizing, which, as you know, I've defended recently on your show. It's a perversion of the practice. I say this because there's a basic truth that pertains to valid generalization, and here it is. While there are differences within groups, there are also differences among them. Now, usually, political correctness causes us to deny the second part of that truth, since nowadays we tend to paint every group with the same brush. But what we have here is a case where political correctness actually causes us to paint every member of a group with the same brush. And let's make no mistake, Michael, that's exactly what's happening here. What happens when it's a Mr. White noose hanger and the question is whether he should be punished for hateful thoughts? Well, let's face it. He's guilty until proven innocent. And let me tell you, that proof always seems to be as elusive as Moby Dick. I mean, we just assume that he must be a bigot.
Well, that's just how white people are. Didn't you know that?
Well, absolutely. You're right, Michael. That is the attitude, 100%. Now, let's think about this. We might as well just say that a black defendant charged with crack dealing must be guilty because he's black, or a Muslim charged with terrorism must be guilty because he's a Muslim, or a man charged with rape must be guilty because he's a man. Of course, we do that already to some degree, to be honest. But listen, it's one thing to look more closely at blacks or Muslims if you're searching for, respectively, crack dealers or terrorists. And if you're searching for rapists, you only look at men. But once a suspect is apprehended, it's a different matter, Michael. If we charge or convict someone based on a stereotype, we're operating on nothing but prejudice. Again, profiling exists for the purposes of identifying suspects, not for the purposes of prosecuting them. So look, I've said this so many times, but this is the problem with hate crime laws. What they do is, Michael, is they make prosecution more subjective. Also, they make the prejudices of the day the determinants of guilt and punishment. And then, look, it's like this. Well, was hatred in the defendant's heart, counselor? Is a hoax tolerable here, Your Honor? Well, I don't know. Tell me the man's skin color, and I'll tell you. Michael, look, we have to ask ourselves this question. Should a criminal proceeding take place in a courtroom or a sideshow? Because if it's the former, mind reading has no place. And I think, quite frankly, it should be chilling to each and every one of us that the government is now the arbiter of not only the acceptability of thoughts, but of their very existence. But look, thank God there is a simple solution. We should punish proven actions, not divined motivations. If I wanted pretenders to clairvoyance, Michael, I wouldn't have to pay taxes. Listen, I just call the psychic hotline. And that's all I have to say about that. Michael, thank you for having me on the show, and God bless you and your audience.
Yeah, may God bless you too, Selwyn Duke. We sure need it.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.
Encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Oh, God, look what I have to do for a living. I should have been a tailor. I could have sat in front of a treadle, not talked to anybody, just smoked Philip Morris and died at 47. Poor grandpa. Didn't have a chance. Came over, brought the family over one by one from Europe. He ate his heart out in that tailor store on the Lower East Side. Made suits for guys, nice suits, never got anywhere. Well, he owned his own store. He moved up. But he didn't have to talk to people like I do 3 hours a day, eating his heart out. I don't know. They all died so young. They had easier jobs than me. Why they dropped dead, I can't understand. It had to be the cigarettes. Don't say stress, because my stress level is 10 times worse than theirs. So don't give me that stress garbage. Mine is 100 times worse. I should have been dead at 11 with my personality and my consciousness. Stress is I studied this. The reason I went into nutrition and herbal medicine and looked for the searches all over the world and wrote all those books is because everyone died young in my family from heart attacks. And stress has almost nothing to do with coronary artery disease. Nothing. Zero. Don't believe a word of it. Life is stress by definition. Don't you understand that? And the more you struggle against stress, the more stressed out you are. Just accept that stress is life. And when you die, you have no stress. You know what I mean? Or if you move to Queens, one or the other. The point I'm making is stress has almost nothing to do with it. It's 90%. Okay, let me tell you what I've discovered and what the medical literature says. And please don't call me on this. We all know it anyway, but let me just say it again. It's about one-third, one-third, one-third for any disease. One-third genetics, one-third environment, and one-third unknown. There's an unknown factor in disease. Don't you understand that yet? I learned this in graduate school when I was going for my PhD. I'll never forget my professor. He was a medical doctor and a PhD, and he said to me, you know, he says, I've opened up people at autopsy who've died of heart attacks whose arteries are perfectly clean. Now, that's a mind blower. No occlusion, you know, Lipitor and garlic and vitamin, nothing. The arteries were clean like a baby, and they dropped dead of a heart attack anyway. So there's a mystery to disease. You understand that there's a mysterious element to disease, as there is to so much else in life. There's a mystery to love. There's a mystery to life. Not everything is so cut and dried. So that's what I say. It's a third environment, which means smoking, exercise, nutrition, eating. A third genetics where you have nothing. You can't do anything about it. And then a third mystery. Now, since you can't affect your genetics, you can't affect your unknowns, you work on the others. That's all. You don't eat like a pig. That's all. You eat like a sane person who wants to live, and you take mega doses of vitamin E and vitamin C and all of the other B vitamins that you need to know, and you got to learn all of that stuff. And then you pray a lot. You pray to God every night that you don't drop dead and leave your children without a father at a very early age. That's everyone in their 30s, 18 times a day, they're touching their chest. Yeah, that's it. They're driving in the car. How many guys listening to this show are laughing right now? They're driving. They're in their 30s. I imagine this because I know it. It was like the 30s are the worst age in life. In the 20s, you're still like, I'm not going to live forever. Nothing's going to affect me. You're in the post-teenage years. Nothing. Then in the 30s, you get the first gray hairs. You get a little flab on your stomach. And every day, if you're married and have children, I mean, if not, well, you can get away with another 10 years. Every day in your 30s, you're driving. Oh, what's that twinge? Oh, and you're sure you're going to go off on the side of the road upside down. You're going to be an embarrassment to your family, dying a horrendous death from the big one. So many guys in their 30s. But let me tell you something. It gets easier as you get older. Because once you realize you are going to die, it doesn't matter. You realize that, you know, don't freak out over it. 40s are easier. Then the 50s are even easier yet. What do I know? Depends upon if you're lucky or not. You don't get sick. My mentors are guys like 80 who aren't, those that have anything wrong with them. Still chasing women at 80. There are, you know, there are still men around like this. Astonishing.
Savage.
I drive into the city, go to this Chinese restaurant. Now, for one, the parking is enough to give you indigestion if you get there. And it's terrible, just awful. That already gives you indigestion. There's no point in going. So I get there. I've eaten there for 20 years, and they still mistreat us. It's just that I don't know if it's the nature of the business. They don't like me. It's racism. I don't know what it is. I can't tell. I get in there. I order a number of dishes, and I'm meeting a friend. And they bring us immediately the pot stickers and the steamed dim sum within 5 minutes. I said, well, tonight's going to be different. Now I'm three beers into the meal, and there are no dishes. And everyone who came in after me is eating. Eight times I get up, where's the food? Then they bring it out, and the rice is at the end. It was a mess, okay, a nightmare. I'm never going there again. But wait, the best is yet to come. My friend John, who's a philosophy professor, shows up a few minutes late. And he comes and he says, I had to park in a driveway around the corner. I hope I don't get a ticket. So right away, that's double anxiety. I don't blame him. There's no parking. Then he runs out 5 minutes later. And he puts a note in his windshield which says, please don't tell me. Call my cell phone number if you want me to move. Sure enough, in the middle of the meal, ring, ring. Oh, I'll be right out. I'll be right out. So I go out with him because John is a philosophy professor and he's not street smart. I just had an instinct I better be with him. Sure enough, there's a crazed Russian in the street. He had parked not only in the guy's driveway, but right against the guy's bumper, and the Russian is insanely mad, screaming and yelling, you have no brains, no brains, no brains, no brains, stupid, stupid, stupid brain, no brains, what, you have no brains? Why are you parking my car? And he's crazy, he's livid. Now, I know how to defuse street situations, and John, the philosophy professor, doesn't know anything about this kind of interchange. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. I'm trying to calm things down. I had had four beers already, so I said to him, look, tell you what, just calm down. You have no brains, no. And he's screaming and yelling the Russian, no brains, stupid. And he's in everyone's face. So I said, this could escalate, turn very bad. You know, guns, knives. You don't know what's going to crazy relatives from the Ukraine could come out with tattoos from jail. You don't know where this is going to go. I'm trying to defuse it. So I'm saying to my friend, look, back the car up. I said, if there's any damage, I will pay you. I figured money talks, right? I wasn't saying it was anyone's fault. No brains. I don't care. Damage. No brains. No brains. And he's on and on with the no brains. I said, look, my friend is a philosophy professor. I don't care. No brains. Why on my car? So I said, John, back the car up. John backs the car up, and there's no damage whatsoever. So the Russian gets down on his knees. He says, no brains. Stupid. No brains anyway. I don't care. Damage. No damage. Stupid. No brains. So I said, look, is there damage? If there's damage, I'll pay. No brains, stupid. Stupid man. I said, look, is there damage? And I was saying, John, get in the car and get out of here. I'm going to take care of it. Go. And John doesn't go. John sits there and starts in with the guy. I want to see you smile. I said, oh, my God. Now, the worst nightmare, you're telling an enraged Russian to smile? What does he think? This is a textbook in Marin County? He wants to see a smile out of an enraged Russian? He parked on his bumper. You know what that's like? That's like pulling out your private part and pressing it against his wife's jeans in the street. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? All right, look. I understand people expose themselves when drunk in Russia, but you don't touch wife's pants with private part. You get killed for this. I mean, it's the equivalent of, what are you parking against the guy's bumper for? It's bad enough to be in the driveway, but if you're going to park there, you don't put it on the guy's bumper. It was like a new car and little, and it looks like the guy worked all his life for his first new car. And to him, this was like a sexual encounter. It's like, all right, in my country, I know they get drunk and they pull it out, but they don't touch wife's pants. It was like on that level of insanity, the guy parked against his car. So I said, get out of here. And he's out of the car telling the guy, I want to see you smile. I figure a relative is going to come out and say, what you say to my uncle? Smile? In Russia, the worst insult, tell him to smile when he's angry. I mean, to me, it looked like it was going to blow up into World War III. So I said to him, get in the car and get out of here. No, not here. So again, telling the guy that he didn't mean it and he wants him to smile. So I said to him, and the guy's screaming, I don't understand America. American people, stupid. Stupid American people. So I said to him, I looked him in the eye and I said, but you like America, don't you? See, I knew how to turn the situation because I know in Russia, a little bit about the Russian mind, which is that you can hate the person, but if you're a guest in another person's country, you don't hate the country, because in his country, you get killed for hating someone else's country or your own country. I mean, he knows from his own reversal that through history, if you say you hated Poland and there's a Polish man in the street drunk, he'll kill you. You see, I hate you, but I like Poland. It's a strange kind of Slavic sense of humor that you have to understand how to defuse these things. He's stupid, friend, no brain. I hate Americans, stupid, don't understand them, but I love America. So it was like that kind of thing. Finally, it ended. So naturally, I'm never going to go back to that restaurant. That's all. You have to have been there. What I should have done is tape recorded this one. This would have been a beauty to have on tape recorded.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
What matters to me is that Teddy's sick, my dog. That's really what it comes down to at the end of the day. The little guy is listless. He's laying around. I think he got a cold. Dogs can get colds. They're moody like people. He was always spunky. Now he like lays around. I have to pick him up and hold him in a blanket. His nose is dry. He's right next to me in the studio now wearing a green corduroy jacket to keep him warm. Well, the weather changed here. I know it's supposed to be global warming, but it got very cold here in Northern California. Our pack ice has apparently melted in San Francisco Bay, and it's delivering cold air. And so consequently, even though it's November and we expect cold air this time of year, it's definitely due to a global warming that it turned cold in November. I was watching the Weather Channel today. I started to laugh hysterically. They were getting hysterical that cold air was coming into Atlanta, Georgia, at the Weather Channel. I started to scream at the television set, "It's November, idiot. It's supposed to be cold. What are you getting excited over? What's wrong with these people? Everything to them is a panic." But Teddy will be better, I guarantee you. He's not eating. I mean, he's not dying or anything. He just got a little, you know, cold. That's all. Dogs get colds. And since I'm a caring man, I will care for the dog in the proper manner. I'll give him ice cream and he'll feel better. That's all. Toby, KNEW, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. Listen to your show often, and usually I agree with you, but today I'm not too happy with your take on the North bit. And just kind of in a nutshell, I just think it's ironic how you always talk about how the preservation of people's cultures. And here you are. Here you have a shining example of someone whose culture is eroding. And
What do you mean her culture is eroding? Because the blueberries didn't come in season. Her culture is eroding. What does that have to do with me? Why is Congress listening to some child, a whimpering child from Alaska, about the fact that the berries didn't come in bloom? What do we have to do with that? I don't understand it. What does Congress have to do with blueberries?
Look, Dr. Savage, you hold the hammer. You're the man. I listen to you every day, but I just think you're being a little insensitive on this matter. And
I am very insensitive to stupidity. I do not suffer fools gladly, and I will not have my Congress try to bamboozle me with emotional speeches by an Alaskan teenager who's an ignoramus. What do you mean? So the berries didn't come into season. So the deer didn't eat the berries. The antelope didn't eat the berries. The bears didn't eat the deer. What can we do about that?
I don't know.
That's what should we, I have an idea. Let us all go to our refrigerators and get ice and put it into a cooler. And then let's all bring these coolers filled with ice to a collection station, as we did cans for Nicaragua after the earthquake. And then we could have a massive airlift of ice trays to Alaska, and we could just drop ice over Alaska. Will that help?
You say so.
Okay, well, you see, you're laughing. Thank you for the laugh. That's all. That's all. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. You know, the fact of the matter is Antarctica now has the largest amount of pack ice ever seen in recorded history. Antarctica, boys and girls, is on the other side of the globe. Remember the globe before the internet? The globe is a spherical item. Our planet is global. That's why they call it global. It's circular. It's not flat. Now, although there is an Arctic, there is also an Antarctic. That's in the south. You have to go south to Mexico, where our illegal aliens come from. And then you keep going south to where terrorism is being percolated by Hugo Chavez. You go all the way down South America to the tip of Tierra del Fuego, and then you keep going across the Straits of Magellan, if I remember correctly. It's a very bad place to go with a boat. And then you come to more ice, and that's called Antarctica. And Antarctica right now has more ice than ever in its history. But you can't tell that to Al Gore, because he only sees one side of the Earth. That's the side that confirms his fantasy called man-induced global warming, so-called anthropogenic global warming. The fact of the matter is, climate changes. There are cycles in climate. There have been little ice ages before and little heat ages before. Right now we're going through a little teeny heat burp in the planet's history. And now we have people in politics and in government who are trying to use this burp in the history of climate change to aggrandize more power. In seventh grade science, what did you learn? Humans consume oxygen and we exhale carbon dioxide, right? And plants ingest carbon dioxide from which they manufacture with chlorophyll and sunlight. Basically starch, meaning the whole food supply, the entire food chain is built upon an adequate supply of carbon dioxide. So what I'm getting at is, although we're going through a slight uptick in temperature and a slight increase in carbon dioxide, the prognosis is actually better for humanity than worse. The exact opposite. If carbon dioxide levels were decreasing, plant life would decrease, and there'd be massive starvation on the globe. Now, how do they not understand this in Congress? For example, during the Cambrian period, that's 550 million years ago, CO2 levels were 18 times higher than they are today, right? During the Jurassic period, when dinosaurs roamed the Earth, carbon dioxide levels were as much as 9 times higher than today, and the Earth was covered with flora, tropical-like flora, wherever you turn, because there was much higher carbon dioxide. So the fact of the matter is that increased carbon dioxide levels is actually beneficial to humanity, incidentally. But having said that, most carbon dioxide on the Earth is created by nature. 96.6% of all carbon dioxide is generated by nature, plants mainly, and by plankton in the ocean, and by animals that exhale. Humans contribute approximately 3.4% of annual CO2 levels. So this whole thing is nonsense. It's being exploited by socialists, both domestic and international, in an attempt to control your life from cradle to grave. And just as we prevailed on the illegal immigration issue, which I've been fighting for since 1994, we're going to prevail on the global warming. It's starting to happen already. In fact, I linked an article on michaelsavage.com that's a must-read for those of you who are open-minded. It's called Debunking Global Warming, and one of them is entitled Proliferation of Climate Skepticism in Europe. And the article says, climate skepticism has now gained a firm foothold in various European countries. In other words, people's natural curiosity and natural skepticism is finally clicking in on the big lie of global warming, so to speak. Eventually, when you discuss a topic long enough and enough facts get out, people will decide for themselves, you know, what's real here. But the problem is that Al Gore won't debate anyone on global warming. He refuses to debate scientists who disagree with him, you see. So there it is. Delaware, David, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, I was wondering if someone could please ask the crying Inuit girl what her people did during the medieval warm period, or the medieval climate optimum, as it used to be called.
Well, I don't know, but she says in her tradition there were always berries and there was ice. Well, but, of course, she's a child who doesn't even know her own traditions or history.
Precisely.
I guess she thinks her traditions consisted of tar paper houses and spam.
I guess, but at some point her people made a move from places that were ice to places that had been ice during the medieval warm period. She doesn't know about that. She wasn't around.
Well, but right. And the little ice age in the 1300s was probably a period that was very good for the people, the Inuit people, I would assume.
They moved closer to the water, I'm sure.
Sure, because the ice was firm. Now they could hunt and such. But the fact of the matter is the world is changing. I don't think this young girl should have spoken to Congress, was my point. Why must we be subjected to the crying of a teenager who doesn't know the science of global climate. I would rather have heard some scientists who have statements to make on both sides of the issue. I think that would have been more constructive, David.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000, or you can send checks to the trust account of Daniel Horowitz. He's my attorney. P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Daniel Horowitz, attorney, P.O. Box 1547, Lafayette, California, 94549. Say it's for Michael Savage. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Go to www.michaelsavage.com, and God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech. Today's show is called Black Dog, Black Man, and here's how it works. Here's how it works, and it's a hard story to tell. It's a hard story to start, but once I get into the story, it's going to be very easy to tell. I don't have a way to begin this story other than to tell you I was on my bicycle before the show in one of my moods. I go in and out of moods and grousing about it. I just read that there was a Russian in New York who bought a $150 million apartment, so I started to get mad, grousing about that, saying I don't understand this world I'm living in. There are guys coming back from Iraq without legs and arms. And this guy has enough money to buy another $150 million apartment. Well, something's wrong with the picture here. So I said, look, I have a choice right now. I could sit here getting angry, or I get on my bicycle and take a 10-minute ride, because I remember that many years ago, 20 years ago, I read a couple of self-help books. And one of them said that in the few minutes that you're sitting there grousing about how bad things are, you can send a letter, make a phone call, run around the block. And you know what? It helped me then, and it helps me now. So I got on the bike, and I went down to a kind of isolated area where they're building some new houses by the water, because I love to watch houses under construction. It's very optimistic to see the wood and the contractors and the this and the that. And I'm out by the point, and I'm coming back, and I see this big black Great Dane off a leash. Now, I happen to be afraid of black dogs. I mean, big black dogs. In fact, big white dogs. In fact, big dogs generally frighten me because I was bitten when I was young, right down to the bone, and had to be hospitalized. So I have a real respect for dogs. So I said, now I got to be very careful as I go by this Great Dane. I don't know whose it is. If I let out anger inside of me, the dog's going to feel it. If I let out fear, the dog's going to fear it. So I said, just be cool and go. Don't go too fast. Don't go. So I go by. The dog doesn't bother me. I said, thank God for that. Then I come upon a guy who's got a truck, who's doing auto detailing. And he's a big black guy. I've seen him once in a while. Huge. I mean, like a football-sized guy. And he comes out of the truck and he says to me, you're looking good. And I said, what? He says, you lose some weight? And we start to talk. I didn't know the guy. I've seen him around. But he thought he knew me. He said he knew me. Not thought. He knew me for a number of years. He's been around this county doing cars. A great guy. I'm going to tell you the story now, where it goes. So one thing leads to another. And he says to me, you remind me of another radio guy I knew. He says, this guy was as smooth as can be. He could walk the ghetto, and he could walk the White House. So I said, you know, let me tell you something. I said, David, I grew up in New York City, and I had to learn how to swim with all kinds of fish. New York City was a very big fish tank. And if you didn't learn how to swim the right way, they'd tear your fins off. And he laughed. He says, well, they wouldn't just tear your fins off. He says, they'd eat you for breakfast. And we started to talk. Now, he grew up in a black ghetto here in Marin County. There is one, and it was called Marin City. It's an interesting story unto itself. The housing was built by the magnate, Kaiser. When they were building Liberty ships in World War II, they needed to bring in workers, and they didn't bring them in from Mexico. They brought workers in from the South, and they were largely black people, and they built housing for them. And you may not know it, but many of the ship workers, you know about Rosie the Riveter, of course, but you didn't know that most of the Liberty ships were built by black people, particularly out here in Sausalito at the Kaiser shipyards. So the housing was built nearby, and it's become basically, largely a black community. And naturally, the way things have evolved in our society, and blame whoever you want, it hasn't been a picnic for the people living in there. So we were walking around, and we were just standing there talking about the dog and the this and the that. So I said, well, how did you come through that place and come out the way you are? You see, he's a pastor. In addition to running a service that, you know, polishes cars, he happens to be a minister. His name is Pastor David Hall. And I'm going to tell you more about that in a few minutes and where this went and how that went there and how positive this man was. And we were laughing. He says, you know, I know people around here, very rich people. He says, their children can't play with anybody. I said, why? He says, well, I told him the reason your kid can't play with anyone is because you've given them everything. They got all these toys. They sit in the house and they play electronic toys. They don't know how to play with anybody. I said, isn't that a shame? And I told him that I'm a people person, that I'm not really alone, right? I don't really like to be alone. But I figured if I got out on the bike, I said I'd run into somebody to talk to. And I said, sure enough, this was like hitting, you know, the triple lottery for me in terms of the kind of person I am. It's like all four cherries came up on that big, slot machine in the sky of humanity. And this goes back to what I told you a story years ago about me and Brother Billy down in Harlem when I was a kid. But that's a whole separate story. But this is going to lead somewhere else. So we're talking and this and that. We look up a hill where they're building the houses above where he's polishing the cars. And he says, when I was a kid, he said, you know what we used to do for fun? I said, what? He said, we'd slide down the hill on like linoleum. I said, I can't believe it. I said, we did the same thing. I said, I lived in a tenement on a block called Longfellow Avenue in the Bronx. And above me was a hill called Bryan Avenue. Between us was a big empty woodlot that had a huge hill on it that was denuded of foliage. And we'd slide down it on oilcloth, you know, old linoleum. And I said, well, we'd also play war. He said, how'd that work? I said, well, we'd take the garbage can covers. We'd put them in our hands, and there'd be like a gang of us. I'm talking kids 5, 6, 7 years old. No one had guns or knives. And the game was to run up the hill against the other street as they were raining ash down upon us. And like Gladiator, bounce, bounce, bing, bing. And I said, my head would get split open 100 times in these things. I always had a knack. I don't know where the ash guys, you know what the ash is from? He says, no. I said, well, in those days, I said, they had garbage that they would burn in incinerators. And the leftover of that burn was like a volcanic ash. You know, thank God they don't do it anymore. And I said, these kids would get the ash out of the incinerator and rain it down upon us. And you'd have to fend it off. You can go home, you can get killed. So I said, many a time I'd come home with my head bleeding, with blood running down my head. And I'd come home, my mother would faint before I got through the door. She was like a panic case. She'd go, oh, my God. And she'd fall on the floor basically screaming and yelling, I'm bleeding, and she's doing nothing. But I said, next door, I had an aunt who was like stoic, like Russian aunt. Nothing fazed this woman. She'd look at me with the sober face, get out the peroxide and bandage it up, and that was it. So he lit up. David did, and he says, when are you going to write that book? I was like, bung. I said, what? He said, when are you going to write that book? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, all those stories of your youth, he says, those are great stories. Well, we talked about so many different things. And it turns out that Pastor David Hall of the Big God Ministries is running a turkey drive for Thanksgiving, and he's trying to, you know, do the right thing. And I'm going to send a little money over there. But the point is, he said, would you like to be with me on the 19th and the 20th as we give out turkeys to the poor? I says, yes. He says, no one will know anything about you. You'll just be another guy handing out turkeys. Yeah, I'm going to hand out turkeys. How do you like that? And send some money for turkeys. So he went back to when he was poor, and he said, I got to tell you, I grew up on welfare. He says, my father left us when I was 5. He says, I'm one of 6 children. And he says, yeah, I ate the government cheese. He says with a big smile. He says, yeah, I grew up on the government cheese. And he says, I'd say to my mother, he says, Mom, if there's a God, why am I hungry? Now I said, oh, God, what a question. I said, kids are so smart. I said, they're brilliant. And he said, my mother told me, never be bitter, never be angry, always have faith. Now, this is the most important part of the story. is the faith that this man had. He didn't turn to bitterness. He didn't turn to anger. He didn't hate Whitey. He didn't hate America. He just did what he did, and he did it, and he did it, and he did it. And you know what? He's the richest man I've met in recent years. He is the wealthiest man I have ever met in the last 10 years. And I've met people with a lot of money. And I said, you know, you remind me of the story that Tolstoy wrote, The Kingdom of God is Within. I said, because you do emanate the goodness. He said, well, Michael, if you don't give anything back, you're going to be empty inside. And this man lives to give because he said in giving he gets love. Now, if this is not the epitome of what the Christian religion today is all about, I'd like to know what is. And so I guess the moral of the story is that the humanity in the other man can never be known until you have a contact with another man. And, oh, I remember what a particular story before I go to the next spot got to him. I said, let me tell you a story. My dad owned a little store, and he had started on the streets of New York with a push cart. He came from the gutter. He was an immigrant with nothing, and he never really became a wealthy man. I said, but he had a little stall inside a store, and he sold first the used things, then he sold some antique things, and he always made a living. We had a house and always food on the table. And I said, well, one day, I said, it was all white people in there. I said, never did you see anyone but white people in that market. Now, remember who I'm talking to now. I'm talking to a stranger who happens to be a black man, who happens to be like you talk about fullback football team, huge man. And we're just looking at each other and talking. So I said, it's an all white store. In comes a black man, well-dressed. And I said, he says to my dad, how much is that? My father says, oh, a certain amount of money. How much is that? He's pointing at different statues. All right, how much is that? How much? He says, I'll take them all. So now the man leaves, writes him a check, and my father pulls me over, and he says, I want to tell you something, Michael. He says, listen to what just happened in this store because it's a lesson you're going to learn for the rest of your life. I said, what's that? He says, never judge a man by the color of his skin. He said, you never know who the man is, you never know what the man is, and you never know what that man's all about until you have an interaction with him. So when I told it to a pastor, Pastor Hall, he says, that is a beautiful story. He says, you've got to tell that story. And so I've just told that story, and I'll be right back.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I ate too much for lunch. I'm sleepy. My mind works fine. I'm just dozy. I mean, you know, it's after Thanksgiving. It's cold. We have the high 30s. Someone will scream global warming. However, I must tell you, I've studied temperature in the Bay Area going back over 100 years. The days were just as cold in December, January, February as they are now. I've seen snow up on the mountains here. The occasional snow, everyone loves it. But don't tell that to the, let's say, the Neolithic thinkers amongst us who are sure that we're causing global warming. But anyway, so, you see, here's the problem, is when you try to do good for yourself, sometimes you do bad. Take me, for example. I went to an Asian restaurant to eat some lunch. I don't know, you know, the Asian restaurant. As I tell them, no fat, I mean, no oil, or less oil and no sugar, and it usually comes out fairly good. So I finish eating, and I'm starving. I had the plate lunch, and I'm starving. I go out. I walk right into McDonald's nearby. I said, why am I doing this? I said to myself, why am I doing this? I just ate lunch in the Asian restaurant. Answer, because I'm starving. And I sneakily ordered a fish burger, but then I said, without cheese and without sauce, with extra onions. In other words, I was, it's like the devil on my left shoulder said, I have the fish burger. The angel on my right shoulder said, all right, at least cut out the cheese, please. The alarm bells were going off. And add onions to it. Onions. So I said, all right. Then the Mexican woman says to me, do you want the sandwich? I said, what do you mean? I knew what she meant. I said, no, give me the French fries too. Now, I got to tell you something. With the Diet Coke, with the thing, I scoffed it down like it was a dessert. It was unbelievable after the good Asian meal. Now, there's no moral to the story other than there's only so much you can do in the world that's good for you. You know what I mean? And then at a certain point, you just got to enjoy a meal once in a while. Like last night, I went to a local hole-in-the-wall, disgusting Thai place that no one goes to except a few local people. The food's excellent. We feel very bad for the guy. His children are always in there doing homework. They're very hardworking people, and his food is very good. It's awful. It's like next to a laundromat. There's nothing more depressing than eating in a restaurant, in a mall, strip mall, next to a laundromat. You say, well, why do you do that to yourself? You can afford any restaurant in the city. Answer, because his food is good, and I don't care about style. I care about the food. I go to eat. I don't go to be seen. I don't go to be heard, and I don't go to – certainly don't want to hear people talk, which is unfortunately this dump. My luck at a table nearby in this empty restaurant was a classic Marin County liberal couple from hell. Let me see if I could describe them. Just say a classic liberal couple from hell. Now, they're in a dump of a restaurant. Every platitude known to liberals came out of that woman's filthy mouth. From global warming, while she's stuffing her fat yap, stuffing a fat yap with food, she's talking about global warming. Then she goes on to, did you hear the story about blacks being underrepresented in law firms, Bob? Oh, yes. Blacks get into major league law firms, but they don't make partnership. Blah, blah, blah. So I start to fume. I'm boiling, and I'm trying not to say a word. I'm like behind a tree in this dump, like a cheap tree, a fake tree, and I'm trying not to see them, but I can hear them. And she won't shut up. Now, I got to tell you, I had a few drinks before dinner, and it made me somewhat loquacious. So I started to talk to my long-suffering Mrs. S as loudly as I could to counter the global warming argument and to counter the blacks in the law firm argument. Then I got outright insulting. And, you know, one thing led to another. Eventually they left. Fortunately, they were smart enough to not make it any worse than it was. Why did they have to do a political discourse in a restaurant? Now, I do this for a living on the radio. You have an option to turn the show off or to turn the show on, to turn the volume up or turn the volume down. When you go to a restaurant, you don't want to hear a moron shooting his mouth off about politics. I find it the most offensive thing in the world for people to speak loud in restaurants, by the way. Some of them scream. But some of them scream about political points of view, global warming, blacks not getting ahead, you name it. You name the issue. And then to top it off, as they were leaving the restaurant, they say to the owner of the Thai restaurant, oh, we're sailing to Thailand or going on a sailing trip in Thailand next week and, I don't know, some whatever, Phuket, I don't know where they were going. And they do the bow with the hands together. He looked at them like they were crazy. He could care less whether they're going there.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
A local host on a small station named Bernard Ward, a real leftist, you know, real leftist, hates the church, blah, 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 was just indicted for possession and distribution of child pornography. Regardless of the outcome of this case, the issue brings up questions in the public sector about how people get this way. How could someone justify sick behavior like this? Now, Ward says he was researching a book. I've been contacted by a woman who has done just that. Anne Hendershot has written The Politics of Deviance with a chapter entitled The Postmodern Pedophile. She has some very insightful info for us. So let's see if she had to examine kiddie porn to write her book about the subject. Hello, Anne. Good to have you here.
Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to be here.
First of all, what was your reaction when you heard about leftist talk show host Ward being charged with possession and distribution of child pornography?
I guess I'm never surprised when I hear this, just because I've done so much research on the resurgence of really of child pornography and somewhat the acceptance of child pornography by the left, by many on the left. It's become almost routine for me to read about this and hear about this. And so I guess I wasn't really surprised. I don't know Bernie Ward, But I do know the kinds of techniques that people use to justify that kind of behavior, and I know probably the defense of doing research is a common one, and one that I guess I just wasn't that surprised. I had mentioned earlier that I did research for a book. I did a book, The Politics of Deviance, and in my book I have a chapter called The Postmodern Pedophile, because I was interested in how that was being redefined. My book looks at deviance and how deviant behaviors have been redefined over the ages. And pedophilia is one that's really a paradox for me. Do you remember the daycare panics a few years ago when everybody was concerned that their children were being abused by satanic cults and sexually abused in daycare centers? And the priest sexual abuse scandal, at the same time that was happening, there was a movement to really redefine pedophilia as a more innocuous kind of a thing. So I kept running across academics, PhD people working in universities here and abroad, interested in redefining that as something called intergenerational sexual intimacy. And so this whole movement was gaining strength. And while priestly pedophiles and daycare pedophiles were being vilified in these exposés, this other kind of pedophilia, the intentional use of children for pleasure, and that would include child pornography, using children, images of children for the sexual gratification of others, and pedophiles are the biggest consumers, the only consumers of such erotica of children. I was interested in how that was happening, how it was being normalized, because that's what my book looks at. How does a deviant behavior go from being deviant, where everyone is appalled by it and disgusted by it, as they were with the priest's abuse, to one that is accepted, and how that gets redefined? So that's what my research is about. How is it that somebody like Bernie Ward could justify in his mind looking at images, if he did, and no one is saying, I'm not saying that he did, we don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, because a lot of people can justify in their minds using this complex system of theories that I teach my students as neutralization techniques or neutralization theories that deviants use to justify their behavior. So someone like Bernie Ward is a good person, perhaps. Let's go on that premise. Good people do bad things sometimes. And in the rest of his life, he may be a wonderful father, he could be a good husband, but he's able to justify looking at images for sexual pleasure of children that everybody, the rest of us, find appalling and deviant. But the way they do that is by neutralizing their behavior. They would say there are several components to it, but I'll just give you a couple of them. Denial of injury is the major component of this. He would say to himself, this is fine. Who's being hurt by this? You know, the ultimate libertarian argument, it doesn't hurt anyone. Now, you and I would say, well, the child who's being photographed and posed suggestively and whatever they're doing to this child to get other people aroused by it, we would say that child is being injured. Well, people who are pedophiles, because they have subscribed to this new redefinition of pedophilia, would say, no, they're not hurt. They're really enjoying this. Children enjoy this. And I know you're saying this is appalling, because I think it's appalling too, Michael. I find it absolutely appalling. But I have read so many essays, scientific papers that have been published in mainstream psychology journals where that is accepted now, that there are people who believe that children can enjoy that. And I write that in my book. I have a section in my book where these kinds of academics have redefined childhood. They say childhood is a social construct. We made that up. We can redefine childhood, too. Not only can we redefine childhood, we can find children who are ready to have sex at age 7. In this one book that I cite copiously in my chapter, The Postmodern Pedophile, is a book called Male Intergenerational Intimacy. And it's a collection of essays by American scholars and Dutch scholars, many with academic appointments. Some of the contributors teach at universities here. Theo Sandford is one of the main authors and the editor of this journal, and he teaches at Columbia. I hear you talking about Columbia often on this program. I guess you wouldn't be surprised that he's at Columbia. Kenneth Plummer is at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and Columbia University. And he's a professor. He's a research scientist. And he goes on and on about maintaining that childhood is not a biological given, but rather it's socially constructed. And if this is true, he would say that childhood can be deconstructed. And he has a line in that book that he's published where he says, a child of seven may have built an elaborate set of sexual understandings and codes which would baffle many adults. Now, that one line I had to include in my chapter. I took it right out of his book and put it right in the chapter because I think that would baffle most of your listeners.
Well, certainly baffled, probably disgusted and offended as well. But how did the process of defining and redefining what pedophilia is and even what childhood is begin? How did we start down this path?
Well, this whole process started a while ago with your favorite group, NAMBLA, the one that the ACLU has given so much help to. In the late 70s, right about 1978, there was a conference that NAMBLA emerged from, and it was a conference that was held in Boston's community church, and it was coordinated by the leaders of the gay movement in Boston. Now, I don't want to conflate pedophilia with homosexuality. Nobody is saying that. I'm not saying that. But some of the leaders of the earliest leaders of NAMBLA emerged from the gay liberation movement. They were pariahs to many within the gay movement. The Log Cabin Republicans want NAMBLA out of the parades. Most mainstream gays want them out. But I have to say that they emerged from those early days in the Boston Community Church, and they were started by leaders of the gay movement in Boston. And it was given instant credibility because they had all of that activism that was already started. From those early days, they went on, and there were people that were involved, and because they had these academic appointments, the neutralization techniques that they were able to use were given credibility, and they're still being given credibility today. I'm sure you remember a few years ago the Senate voted to deplore an article that was published by the American Psychological Association saying that child sexual abuse didn't cause harm, that they were kind of lauding this article that was published by Bruce Rind and a guy named Trumovich. Bruce Rind is at Temple, actually, right now. Bruce Rind was one of the authors, and he published an article in the Psychological Bulletin, and, well, people went crazy. I mean, Matt Solomon of Arizona said it, you know, that we just can't allow this, and they deplored it. Congress voted on it, saying that this is a horrible thing. The norms against pedophilia are strong in society, but there is always this undercurrent that supports it. And the undercurrent is given credibility because it's not just weirdos with NAMBLA. These are people with university appointments. Bruce Rind, like I said, is at Temple. Theo Sanford is at Columbia. Philip Trumovich, who is the co-author of the study published by the American Psychological Association, has a PhD from Penn. He's now teaching in Tokyo. One of the more famous ones is Edward Brungersma from the Netherlands. Now, he's not in the United States. He died recently, which is interesting also because I know on your show you talk a lot about the tie between sexuality and the liberation movements and death, and they are closely related, and that's an area of research for the future for someone. I'm fascinated by it. This Edward Brungersma, he's the author of a couple of really obnoxious books, but he's an academic. He wrote Loving Boys and then Loving Boys 2. There were two books that he wrote, and he chose to end his life last year. I think it was last year or maybe a few years ago. He just decided that he didn't want to live anymore, so he's in the Netherlands, so he was able to choose euthanasia. And he's kind of like the father of the pedophile movement, Brungersma. And I thought it was interesting that he chose euthanasia as a way to die, because I think it's emblematic of the whole movement, that you can choose almost anything you want in this movement.
These are astonishing correlations, Anne. Can you explain what these redefinitions mean for our society and our future?
Well, I think they're obvious that if we redefine childhood and define it away and say that a child of seven has built this elaborate sexual possibility, they're very dangerous. But it's not surprising. And I would also have to say that there's not a whole lot of movement for man-girl sex as much as man-boy sex. So a lot of this undercurrent is more of same-sex. But many of the sites who talk about man-boy love also talk about just very young children. So it's not so much that it's not a homosexual thing, and I want to make that clear, and I know you don't want to ever want to make that mistake. But child pornography is a form of sexual abuse, and pedophiles view pornography. So there is a tie, and anyone who says that there isn't is just wrong. And the idea of doing research for 5 years for a book is pretty hard to believe. I guess Mr. Ward had been investigated in 2005. As far as I can tell, there's not a lot of good research yet about this, but I just know that this has been going on for a while. His computer was taken, I think, and although there were no images found at that time, this has been going on for a long time, which makes me kind of skeptical about his whole idea. You know, few people are good all the time or all bad all the time. They drift from one to the other, sometimes deviant, sometimes conventional. But when they hang around and visit these chat rooms and talk to other people who are also academics, also intellectuals like Mr. Ward is, and very smart, very articulate, they learn these subterranean values, and they begin to internalize them, and they begin to believe them, and that's what neutralization theory is. I'm not a psychologist, but it's a sociological theory of learning and control. And it seems to me that Mr. Ward doesn't control a lot of things in his life. I think he allows himself to enjoy life, and I think he thinks that this is something that he should be allowed to enjoy.
And if he thinks he should be allowed to enjoy naked children, I'm sure that NAMBLA, I mean the ACLU, I mean NAMBLA, would be happy to come to his defenses. Well, it's good to know you don't have to look at child pornography to write a book about it, any more than you have to shoot somebody to write about murder. Anne, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michael, for having me on the show. I always enjoy talking with you.
Anne Hendershot, the book is The Politics of Deviance.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
And then a former CIA agent would discuss these kinds of things, because once you describe what techniques are being used, and they are far less serious and threatening than techniques we use on Marines and pilots who go through our training, then the high-value detainees will never speak to us.
See the damage that Barbara Boxer, Jane Harmon, and the Democrats are doing to our ability to win the war on terror? Our own men are subjected to tougher techniques than waterboarding, but that doesn't concern them. Now, Phil Newmark is the board operator for this show, and he has just volunteered to go on record right now saying he would be subjected to waterboarding right on this program to show you that it's not torture. Phil, is that right? Come on the air.
Yes, sir. I would do it in a heartbeat.
Phil, do you have any military experience?
None whatsoever.
And you're still not afraid of waterboarding. You know what it is?
I know exactly what it is. I've seen it in movies. I've seen Code Pink do it. I'm more than willing to step up and experience it firsthand before, you know, I make any judgments on it.
All right. But you're willing to be waterboarded live on the air on the Savage Nation sometime in the future. We'll have to get somebody from the CIA to do it, or somebody who knows how to waterboard you. Would you rather be waterboarded for 30 seconds or eat Jane Harmon's ravioli?
Oh, it would definitely be the waterboarding, sir.
Would you rather be waterboarded or be in the same room with Barbara Boxer after a family argument?
I'm going to have to ask to be waterboarded twice.
And the last question, would you rather be waterboarded or eat Nancy Pelosi's tortellini?
You put a bullet in my head before I'll eat that tortellini.
All right, we're on record, Phil. We'll have to find somebody willing to waterboard you. Thank you for the call. I read an interesting story in a boating magazine on the way home that has a lot to teach us. It's about a man who owned a mega yacht, like 134 feet. This is a mega yacht, a certifiable mega yacht. One of the, you know, the great, beautiful boats of the world. So the crew was delivering it from Fort Lauderdale to somewhere in the Caribbean. I don't know where. What happened was, is a lot of these mega yachts have been designed recently to have stern doors, you know, in the back of the boat. For those of you who don't have boats, these are big boats. And the back lifts up and out come, oh, various water toys, you know, like speed boats, ski-doos. Some of them even have submarines that come out of the back. The problem is some of these doors are not waterproof, or watertight, rather. They're waterproof. You know, like the raincoat you bought, let's say, at Brooks Brothers when you were 18, and the man said to you it's water-resistant, and you went out in the rain and got soaked down to your shirt, and you came back in fuming, and you said, but you said the raincoat was waterproof, and he looked at you and said, no, I said it's water-resistant. Now, I had that happen to me when I was 17, so I learned the difference between water-resistant and waterproof very young as a result of a raincoat I bought in Brooks Brothers when I was trying to be, a business type in New York, or look like a business type when I was a humble welfare worker. I worked in the welfare department then as a teacher. But the fact of the matter is, so the crew goes out in this big mega yacht, which you think is unsinkable, and this boat sinks. The doors pop open, the seas break through the back, the water comes rushing in. Next, the waterproof barrier in the boat, the watertight compartment, breaks, or the crew had left the door open. The boat floods. Now, it doesn't go down right away, but there's so much water sloshing around inside the boat, going up the three stories of staircases. It's destroying the silk wallpaper. It's destroying the silk sheets. It's destroying the art on the walls. And the boat is now suddenly unstable. Then the pumps fail on the boat at the same time. It's like the perfect storm all over again. Well, the moral of the story is that none of us are as secure as we think we are. And although we think that, let's say many people who are wealthy in particular, think that they're immune from any kind of occurrence like this, that it can't happen to them. They're above it all. They think that they're above it all and it could never affect them. The fact of the matter is there's a lesson in this story for all of us. And that boat is very much like America as far as I'm concerned. That ship I am describing to you with doors on the rear that opened for the toys to come out and instead became flooded with seas that entered are very much like this country. And I'm terrified that the captain that we have, the crew that we have running the good ship America, are about as incompetent as the crew that ran that ship. And eventually they had to be lifted off that ship by helicopter. And the helicopter, the Coast Guard helicopter crew, by the way, were real heroes.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.